I'm Jen Taylor Skinner, and this is The Electorate. On this episode, Shannon Watts, the founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America.
Isn't that nice?
Today's guest needs no introduction. Shannon Watts, the founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, a personal hero of mine, is here to discuss everything from gun legislation to the causes and solutions to gun violence, the 2020 election, and of course, the state of the NRA. And we also talk about her new book, Fight Like a Mother, which you can pre-order right now on fightlikeamother.org. The majority of the book's proceeds will go to nonprofits that are working to end gun violence. Just another reason Shannon Watts is my hero. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Shannon Watts. Shannon Watts, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor.
I'm so excited to talk to you. I don't know if you actually remember me from a couple of years ago when we met. Maybe not. You meet lots of people.
When did we meet?
We met in DC 2 years ago, and we met at some conference, but it doesn't matter. I was sitting in the front row and I was just like, you know, oh, it's Shannon Watts, and she has great things to say.
That's so nice.
But I do have to tell you a story before we start, because this is really, really important to me, because I knew of you well before we met in DC. So I guess it was in 2012, my son, who is now 7, he was about 1.5. And I was about to, and you know this feeling, I was about to take him off to preschool for the first time. And we were touring a preschool in December of 2012. And you know that date and what's poignant about that. So on that day of Sandy Hook, you know, I was, you know, kind of sad about, you know, my kid going off to preschool for the first time. And I was a stay-at-home mom that whole time. And so this was going to be my first time, you know, with him being out of the house. So it was already a pretty kind of emotional day. And, you know, I come home and I turn on the news. And of course, you know what happened, you know what I see. And I was living in Seattle at the time. So I see Sandy Hook, and I think I was just frozen. I was just beside myself. Seattle was far away from what was happening, but it just didn't register with me. But I think a lot of us, we couldn't wrap our brains around it.
Yeah, I think that is the feeling so many millions of women and mothers had that day, which was that our children weren't safe in school. And I talk a lot about how that day I realized I had been living in a bubble. Not only were my children not safe at school, but gun violence was a serious crisis in this country that kills 100 Americans every day, not just the school shootings or the mass shootings, but the daily gun violence in city centers and the rural gun suicides that all accumulate to create this crisis. And it's so important to decide to get off the sidelines, and many do for the reason you just stated, which is they send their toddler or their kindergartner to a daycare or to school, and they have to essentially rehearse their deaths in a bathroom as if that door is going to protect them from the spray of an AR-15. And I think that's when so many parents realize that, you know, we don't have to live this way and it isn't tolerable. But at the same time, there's so much gun violence in this crisis that goes unheeded, and there's no spotlight shined on it. And that's also the gun violence that we have to address.
Yeah. And you did something, because I remember that. I remember it was shortly after that, maybe a few weeks or a few months, I saw you on television. And it was probably your first interview on MSNBC.
I was probably terrified.
Yeah. I remember you said, they said, you know, when did you become an activist? And you said, I'm a stay-at-home mom. And you said something like, Congress locked the door and, you know, moms are going to come through the window or something like that. And, that was the first time I cried, because I thought, she gets it. I felt that things were going to be okay.
I was operating on anger. You know, I had never done a television interview in my life. And here I was sitting in the studio in Indianapolis, looking at a completely, you're just looking into a black camera lens. You can't see the other person on the other end. You don't know what they're doing or how they're reacting. But I had the courage to do that, even though I was terrified of public speaking, because I was so angry. And I do think it's important to harness the same emotions of anger and fear that drive gun extremists to drive us to speak up, to use our voices, to not be intimidated, and to speak as moms who are the chief caretakers in this country. And that is what drives me every single morning to wake up on this issue. I wake up and work on this issue as a full-time volunteer, as well as the hundreds of thousands of other volunteers who do the same.
That's amazing. But you know who's scared now? The gun lobby. I didn't even have to finish that. The NRA, they're scared. You sound strong. They sound scared.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen, but they've been attacking me for the last 5 days. My book publisher believes it's a gift from the heavens. Why they decided to attack me 3 days before Mother's Day in an unrelenting fashion on Instagram and Twitter, I don't know, except to say, one, they do want me to be afraid and they do want me to be silenced. But two, they're trying to distract from all the issues they have. And you know, I'm sure we'll get into that, but I've always said, and this is a very mom thing to say, but our job is to shine a flashlight under the refrigerator and force the cockroaches to run out. And we've been doing that now for over 6 years. And I think what America has seen is a very grotesque underbelly to the gun lobby, and that we've been letting these people who are clearly grifters, they're greedy, and they really don't have a moral compass. We're letting them write our gun laws.
We talk about politicians being afraid of the NRA. They should be afraid of moms.
I think they are. And I think they have been. And I think their worst nightmare was that women and mothers who make up the majority of the voting electorate, that they would organize and that they would go up against them, was always their worst nightmare. And here we are. We outmaneuvered them. We outspent them in the midterm elections. And we are only getting stronger. And they are at the weakest point they've ever been in their history.
Yeah. You know, speaking of which, I was looking at the cover of your book, which I ordered three copies. I pre-ordered three copies.
Thank you. I should say here that the majority of the proceeds do go to gun violence prevention organizations. So the more the merrier. Thank you.
Yeah. So on the cover, it's so powerful. It's you marching next to Lucy McBath. And for people who don't know who Lucy McBath is, she's a newly elected congresswoman who's representing Georgia. And she became a gun control advocate and activist after losing her son to gun violence.
Yes.
How did you meet Lucy McBath?
It's a very interesting story about how sort of all roads lead to the same point eventually. I got a call that there was this amazing woman in Georgia whose son had been killed just weeks before the Sandy Hook school shooting. His name was Jordan Davis. He was a teenager who was at a gas station playing loud music with his friends. A middle-aged white man told him to turn his music down. He wouldn't. This man opened fire into the car, killing Jordan. And Lucy immediately became an activist. This happened when Jordan was at his father's house in Florida. She lived in Georgia. And her father had been an activist with the NAACP. So this was something that came very naturally to her, despite her incredible, profound grief. And someone said, you have to meet her. You have to talk to her because you have the exact same goals. And importantly, she's a woman of color who can speak on how gun violence impacts marginalized communities and Black boys and men in this country. And so we had a phone call. I can still picture myself, you know, sitting in my house talking to her for the first time. And to know Lucy is to love Lucy, but it's also to just know that she's this incredibly special human who really had such amazing charisma and kindness and compassion, despite all she had been through. And this was just months after. And I asked her, would you please be a national spokeswoman for our organization? Not knowing what that really even meant. You know, we were only a few months old. We couldn't afford to pay anyone at that point. But she was getting ready to go through her first trial in Jordan's case. And so she said yes, thankfully. And that is how we built both our Georgia and Florida chapters, frankly, was support around Lucy and helping and supporting her during the trial. And something Lucy will tell you is that every time we've had a conversation over the last 5 years, 6 years, I would say to her at the end, you know, when are you running for office? And, you know, I was thinking like state house, city council. I don't, you know, I certainly wasn't thinking Congress. Mm. And I can remember a conversation we had after Parkland where I said, as we hung up, when are you running for office? And she said, you know, I have been running for state house, but I'm going to run for Congress. This is the time. This is the moment. And she did. And she won.
Yeah, she did. I'm gonna tear up again. I just, you know, when I think about you too, just so moving. And, you know, I've never met Lucy, but, you know, you can just see her power and her strength, right? And her conviction.
Oh, Lucy is just such an amazing speaker. I mean, you feel so moved when you hear her speak because she you know, she channels that anger and that passion, but she's also incredibly kind and compassionate. And this is her life's work. You know, within 5 days of the congressional session this year, she was a co-sponsor of the most sweeping piece of legislation to pass any chamber of Congress in 20 years, H.R. 8, which would close the background check loophole. And just to be sitting there in the gallery and watching this happen and watching her go up there and talk about this bill and her son, it's like something from a movie. You know, it's watching history being made.
You know, speaking of history and politics and, you know, the 2020 campaign, of course, which I'm sure you're watching really closely, I feel like this is the first time in my adult life where I've seen candidates speak so confidently and openly about their views on gun control and gun reform, right? Mm-hmm. And Eric Swalwell, you know, he's the representative from California. Why did you laugh?
I went shooting with Eric recently.
Did you really?
Yes. He took me to a gun range with veterans. He is a good guy.
Yeah. He does seem funny. He does seem like a funny guy. Like, anyway. So, but his whole platform, he said he's running as the gun control candidate.
Yep.
So what's so appealing about his platform to you?
Well, it's really taking a step back and looking at all of the candidates, right? So every single, what are there, 22 now?
Something
all
like
of them
that.
Support stronger gun laws. And there's not a lot of gray there. So they're competing with one another to be the most substantial on this issue. And even today, Kamala Harris came out with a new plan around AR-15s. Last week, it was Cory Booker. The week before that, it was Eric Swalwell. And so this is a sea change in American politics. You know, if you remember in 2016 and before that, politicians felt like in order to be even able to speak about this issue, they had to show how they loved duck hunting or they went skeet shooting or whatever it was in order to ease into the issue. And they were always on defense, worrying, is this something that's going to impact me negatively? And what Hillary Clinton clearly found in 2016 from polling was that, no, this is not polarizing. It takes people out and gets them to the polls. And she created Mothers of the Movement. She said the NRA was her biggest enemy. She said she would immediately overturn many of the bad protections for the gun lobby if she were elected. And it really distinguished her from Bernie Sanders. It's why we endorsed her in the primary. This year, you know, it is tough to distinguish who is the best. And I'm sure, you know, that will become clear as we get closer to 2020. But even the only candidate so far to primary the president, Bill Weld, supports gun safety. And so really, right now, Donald Trump is the odd man out.
You know, you're absolutely right. Like even Kamala Harris, she said she'd take executive action, right?
Yep.
You know, so I mean, they're not hiding from this anymore. And that makes me feel really good. So
it should. And this is in part because of all the momentum we've built on the ground, right? We started this work trying to pass Manchin Toomey right after the Sandy Hook school shooting. This bill was bipartisan between a Republican senator and a Democrat senator. It should have passed. It was stymied by a handful of senators, including some Democrats who, there's not a single Democrat still in Senate, by the way, that voted against that bill. And we had lost that narrowly, but the silver lining in that loss was that we pivoted and started doing this work immediately in our state houses and in local boardrooms, even though Congress wouldn't act after Sandy Hook, governors did. And we also then realized, okay, we have to play defense too, not just offense. There are all these horrible bills that the NRA is trying to pass in our state houses, and we have a 90% track record of killing those bad bills. But it became clear to us early on that Congress was not where this work begins, it's where it ends. And what we would have to do is create a movement that had enough power to persuade Congress, the Supreme Court, and others that this was the direction our nation was headed in. And that's what we've been doing for the last 6 years.
Yeah. You know, there's something I've always wanted to ask you. Dana Loesch, is she for real? I mean, she just seems like a caricature, and she seems, you know, preoccupied with you. What is going on with Dana Loesch.
It's such a fascinating evolution over the last 6 years. She started making me the target of her ire. And people who listen to Dana Loesch don't realize that she's on, you know, 9 right now for who she is. She, before she was hired by the NRA, right around the time of the Parkland shooting, she engaged constantly in ad hominem attacks. And she was just so brutal on Twitter. She once showed up at a public event where I was with my kids with a full camera crew and tried to, you know, badger me into having a discussion with her. Just incredibly strident. And she's been defanged a lot. It's hard to believe, but it's true, over the last several years, because she has to abide by some moral parameters now that she is a spokesperson for the NRA. But her behavior is cartoon-like to me. I don't understand how someone could be so oblivious to the pain and suffering. You know, she does go after gun violence survivors online. She lies in order to put her agenda forward, as do many of the NRA spokespeople. You know, I don't know if she's willfully obtuse or has bought into all of this hook, line, and sinker. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with the NRA and her job now that they are in such disarray, and what her future looks like.
You know, it's funny, I'd forgotten about that, but now I remember. I remember when she followed you at that event with the cameras. I remember that now.
Yeah, it was a very bizarre experience. I mean, I personally can't imagine showing up uninvited and harassing someone in front of their children, but that's just a tactic of the gun lobby and gun extremists.
You know, I was watching an interview with her. It was around the same time. I think it was it 2014 or 2013? So she kind of came on the scene as a public conservative shortly after Sandy Hook. And you're right, she's evolved to this kind of like cartoonish character, you know, but she said she used to be a progressive, which I, you know, in that interview, she said she used to be a progressive, and I don't see that, but you know, that's neither here nor there.
I think she's a little bit of an opportunist. You know, my understanding is she was raised by progressive Democrats in Missouri, which there are not a lot of those. and that, you know, she married this guy, Chris Loesch, who is a gun extremist. And I think a lot of her beliefs and behavior have been shaped by that.
So speaking of Dana Loesch, let's talk about the NRA and what's happening there, because they seem to be imploding, right? Yeah,
they do. So they have been showing signs for a while now that they are in a precarious financial position, that they made a lot of bad bets. For example, they put all their eggs in the basket of CarryGuard, which many gun violence prevention advocates have called murder insurance. They really thought, you know, that that would be something that was a moneymaker for them long term. And it's been slapped down by a lot of attorney generals across the country. They had invested heavily in NRA TV. An article came out yesterday saying it had about 49,000 visitors every month, which is negligible, less than a newspaper online in Oklahoma.
Less than my podcast.
So that did not work out so well. And what's interesting is that we're seeing more and more about the NRA's relationship with this firm. It's basically advertising and marketing called Ackerman McQueen. And it looks like they've been paying them, you know, tens of millions of dollars to handle these projects, none of which have been successful. It also looks like they've been funneling hundreds of millions of dollars to friends, family, friendly contractors. And all of that is completely unacceptable behavior for a nonprofit that is tax exempt. Even this weekend, we saw files leaked that show that Wayne LaPierre has been spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on travel that looks suspiciously personal, and on a wardrobe, in particular suits from a Italian clothier in Beverly Hills. So, you know, I think that all of this is not to point that the NRA is in danger of failing, because I don't believe that. But it is certainly going into the 2020 elections very hobbled and cash poor.
Yeah, I don't know if it was 2016 or 2018 or both, where they spent the least than they ever had in history on an election.
2018, yeah. 2016, they invested about $30 million alone in Donald Trump's campaign. Overall, they spent over $50 million, more than they'd ever spent before. Because of their status as an organization, they don't have to disclose where that money came from. And that's why their ties to Russia are of such interest right now to Congress. But they certainly didn't have that same cash flow in 2018. And if you look at the return on investment for their election spend, even just since 2010, it's been dwindling. And it goes to show a weakening sense of power. And that is what we hope will change the hearts and minds of lawmakers, even if it's just a change that is political expedience. We've seen lawmakers like John Kasich and Kirsten Gillibrand and Tim Ryan and a whole host of others at the federal level and even more at the state level who are rejecting the NRA and their money now for a variety of reasons.
I want to talk about the kids, right? Because that's where we started. And I think a lot about that. And the trauma that they're enduring right now is multi-layered. They hear the news about the school shooting. So that's one layer of trauma and anxiety. And then they have these active shooter drills at their schools. When I was reading about that the other day, kids are fainting, you know, they're having anxiety attacks. And I just, you know, and then the other layer is all of this extra policing and school guards and talking about arming teachers. I mean, this is just insane. You know, what do we do here? What's the right thing to do for these kids?
It is tragic. You know, we are harming an entire generation of Americans. We're making them afraid to go to school. I live in Colorado. Just a few weeks ago, I woke up to a text saying that my son did not have school because an 18-year-old had flown to Denver, gotten a long gun and ammunition, and was essentially terrorizing the state. 500,000 kids didn't have school that day. And then a few weeks after that, there was this horrible shooting in Highlands Ranch, just a few miles away. And parents are grappling with how to explain this to their children. And children are grappling with, you know, am I even safe in school? And what makes me so angry is the vast majority of lawmakers and school officials are men. And they are making the laws and the policies that impact the lives of women and mothers and teachers, the vast majority of whom, you know, teachers are in this country are women. And if you see some of the stories about the lockdown drills that are taking place, they are so insanely over the top. Indiana just is trying to pass a bill now that would allow teachers to be essentially shot with rubber bullets to make them feel the urgency of a mass shooting. And it just is so outrageous and so wrong. And, you know, I just think that we are raising an entire generation of kids who are really going to resent that we put them in harm's way in so many different ways.
Yeah. You know, I think I read a story where one school district actually did that. They used pellet and people were injured. Like the teachers were actually injured, which is insane. And then some schools, they aren't even telling the kids that it's a drill.
It's outrageous. And you know, we already have such high levels of anxiety among children in this next generation. And this, maybe we may find out later that this was a root cause, that they did not feel safe in any public space. And I can't imagine that. I can remember how scary Cold War drills were. And that seemed like a very distant, unrealistic threat to hide under my desk as if, you know, that was going to protect me from nuclear fallout. Children feel the very real threat of school and gun violence.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a hard thing for me to talk about because I like to deal in data and probability. And I was just reading the other day that, you know, I think the probability of this happening at a school is something in like 600 million, one in 600 million or something like that. Right. I mean, just specifically in schools, not, you know, mass shootings generally. But, you know, as a mom, that's hard for me to digest because I don't want to deal in probability. I just want there to be a zero chance.
Well, and the other data point to look at is how much more likely it is to happen in America than in any of our peer nations. Americans are 25 times more likely to be killed by gun homicide. American women are 16 times more likely to be killed with guns than are women in peer nations. And so gun violence does feel like a very real threat because about one in three Americans knows someone who has been impacted by gun violence. And that's really the comparison to make. No other nation, and we saw this in New Zealand, right? No other nation would tolerate the kind of gun violence that we endure on a daily basis.
No, you're absolutely right. But I mean, just in the cases of schools, because yep. I guess my point was, is that, is it worth putting kids through this trauma? Obviously it isn't. What's the best way to help deal with this at a school level versus going through these traumatic drills?
Yeah. Well, look, I understand, you know, we have fire drills, we have earthquake drills. I was actually just at Levi's speaking to their employees. Levi's has become very involved in this issue. And the CEO there has a 10-year-old in a San Francisco school and said that their kid does more lockdown drills than they do earthquake drills in San Francisco. So I think that it's fine to be prepared, but the real focus should be getting guns out of the hands of dangerous people, requiring safe storage. So many of these school shootings are committed by teens who have easy access to guns in their homes, for example, in Highlands Ranch. And there are ways to prevent these shootings. Every single nation is home to kids who are unstable or people who are unstable, who play video games, who watch R-rated movies, who play, you know, M-rated video games. Only America gives them easy access to arsenals and ammunition.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. Right. But the Republicans and conservatives, they would rather focus on the actual games, you know, video games versus real gun control or real laws that would actually reduce the shootings.
Well, I mean, if first-person video games resulted in gun violence, then Japan would have a very serious gun violence problem. And in fact, they have some of the least gun violence of any developed nation in the country. And that's because they don't have easy access to guns.
Yeah. So speaking of that, so speaking of New Zealand and speaking of Japan, what country has a good model that you could see us adapting in America?
You know, it's really difficult to say because America is so unique and only America has a Second Amendment. Only America has a gun lobby. But there are countries like Switzerland and Israel and others that actually have a lot of guns. They just have incredibly strong gun laws. I mean, in Israel, you have to put your gun away at sundown. And there was a mass shooting a few years ago in Israel, and the next day they passed stronger gun laws. It's a country that's able to live with guns in the hands of civilians, but they're highly trained and they have strong laws. We have neither of those things. So we have to look at where laws have worked in our country, right? So I think Missouri is a really interesting example. It's a state that had incredibly strong gun laws. They elected a Republican governor and legislature that promptly overturned all of those laws, including passing something called permitless carry. And immediately, gun homicides and gun suicides went through the roof. And that is in large part because they do not have the laws that they had in place before. And we can look at those laws in other states and see how they work. Red flag laws in Connecticut have significantly reduced gun suicides. States that require background checks, states that keep guns out of the hands of domestic abusers, states that require responsible storage. Believe it or not, Florida is one of those states. They lead to fewer gun deaths. And they are a template that can be followed across the country and even at a federal level.
Yeah. You know, Swalwell, Eric Swalwell, has mentioned Australia's gun buyback programs. And I know Hillary Clinton, this was kind of overlooked, but she mentioned this too in 2016. I mean, I don't know. Is that a model to look to?
Part of the problem you are talking about is that we don't fund gun violence research in this country because the NRA was able to get Congress to stop doing that, essentially, back in the 90s. And when that happened, it became very difficult to figure out what was causing this crisis and how we could stop it. And the reason the NRA wanted to do that was because a study had come out that said having a handgun in your home alone, just having a handgun in your home, increased the likelihood that someone in that household would be killed by gun violence. I mean, that seems pretty intuitive. But that study caused them to create these protections for themselves. We have to start funding gun violence research in this country. But when you look at a state like Washington that actually passed an assault weapons ban via ballot initiative just a couple of years ago, you can start to see whether the proposals from some of the presidential candidates would work. And we just don't know the answer yet. I think it's important that we figure that out. The assault weapons ban in the 90s was not working. The NRA and the gun lobby has found a way, and gun manufacturers, to completely get around that ban by just creating small tweaks to semi-automatic rifles that then exempt it from the ban. For example, the gun used in the Sandy Hook school shooting would have been banned, but he could have gotten a semi-automatic rifle that looked just like it with minor modifications that would have been perfectly legal. So, you know, we are going to continue to do that research. We will eventually make a recommendation and we will work with whoever is the Democratic candidate to figure out what is the best solution. But, you know, Beto has basically said, don't sell them anymore, but people who own them are grandfathered in. Swalwell has said, you know, we'll do this buyback program. Kamala says she would talk about an executive order. So there's all different ways to go at it. And we're still sort of grappling with what would be the best.
Right. And if we can't study it, then we can't really figure out what is the best solution. I get that.
Which is exactly what the NRA wants.
Yeah. So tell me about your Be Smart campaign.
What we realized early on was that our volunteers really wanted to talk about safe gun storage, responsible gun storage, because it impacts both gun owners and non-gun owners. It is a non-polarizing way to talk about restoring the responsibilities that go along with gun rights. And also because so many children in their communities were being injured or killed in unintentional shootings. 4.5 million American kids live in homes with unsecured guns, meaning they're not locked, they're loaded, they're not separate from ammunition. So we talk about how important it is to ask this question. You know, when you go to friends and family members' households, do they have guns and how are they stored? It should be the same question as, do you have a pool and how is it kept safe? Do you allow kids to play M-rated video games? You know, my kid has a peanut allergy. It should be part of that laundry list. And we help people understand how to have the conversation. But we also educate them about what is responsible gun storage. And we have partnered with a PTA and we've given these presentations now thousands across the country. And it's just a really life-saving but also compelling way to get involved in this movement.
Yeah, you know, I actually started doing this years ago. When people would come to my house, I'd be proactive about it. And I would say, this is our house. You know, these are the bathrooms are here. We don't have, you know, any pets in case you're allergic. And we also don't have any guns. Just FYI. I want to do it that way to make them feel comfortable doing the same thing when other people come to their houses.
Yeah, it can be uncomfortable because, you know, sometimes people can feel like you're making a judgment. And that's not what this is about. I wouldn't say that a kid couldn't go play at a gun owner's home. Unless that gun owner said, you know, I keep a loaded handgun in my nightstand, and then that would be a deal breaker. But I've met so many volunteers, and I even have had this happen to myself, where they've had the conversation and they've been surprised at what the answer was. And they had to say, this is how you responsibly store your guns. And until they're stored this way, you know, my kid can't play at your house or can't come over. And that can be a really tough discussion with in-laws or people that you're related to.
Yeah. So tell me, when does the book come out? It comes out in about a little over a week, right? And it's called Fight Like a Mother.
It comes out May 28th. It's called Fight Like a Mother. You can pre-order it now. Majority of the proceeds will go to gun violence prevention organizations, including Moms Demand Action. And it really has been a labor of love. It's part memoir in that I talk about my own journey and the impact being a full-time volunteer in this movement has had on my family and on my life and what it's like to sort of be the tip of the spear. It's part manual. I've had so many women call me and say, you know, I want to start something like this in my community or my neighborhood or my state, but I'm really passionate about a different issue. How did you do it? And so I wanted to create that, put it on paper. And then, you know, it's part manifesto. It's really about how women can learn these skills. And then really, in many ways, these days, they have a moral imperative to parlay that into running for office. And I don't care if it's school board or city council or sheriff or, you know, like Lucy McBath, Congress. But I do think the way this issue and so many other social issues that are problematic right now, the way those get solved is by having more women with a seat at the table. You go into a state house, and I highly recommend anyone listening, go to your state house, attend at least one hearing. You know, we go to gun bill hearings all the time. And what you will see is a mostly male environment. And I honestly wouldn't trust many of them to get me a cup of coffee, let alone make the laws that are protecting my family. And so it's really important that women are making these laws and not just using their voices and their votes, but they're moving from shaping policy to making it. And my book talks about that too.
Wow. You know, I'm going to have to pick up more because I want to give them out to everyone.
That's right. If you buy 10, and you could do it on fightlikeamother.org. If you buy 10, save your receipt and there's a box you can check and I will do a virtual event with you. Like if you have a book club or you just have a get together, they're really fun.
Oh, excellent. I didn't know that. Yeah. Okay. You just sold 10. Okay. but I just want to say, I want to close out by just saying thank you, not just for this interview, but thank you for everything that you've done. And, you know, because I know that you get threats and I know that this is, I mean, you put yourself at the front of this fight and this is a scary, big, big fight. And you did it.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you. I have to say, I would never have been able to do it without this huge badass army of women who hold me up every single day and make me feel like I can do anything. It really has become a sisterhood. And if you came to our annual Gun Sense University, you'd see a whole lot of moms with Moms Demand Action tattoos. and so it's all because of them and their hard work. But thank you.
Excellent. Okay. I would get a tattoo now.
Yeah. I haven't gotten one yet either.
Thank you so much for listening. You can find information about the book Fight Like a Mother in today's show notes. If you like this episode, please let me know by leaving a review on iTunes. If you want to further help the electorate, please do one more thing. Please hit the subscribe button. Subscribing to a podcast is free. And please ask anyone you know to subscribe. Lastly, please follow the electorate on social media. That's at electorate on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And until next time, keep up the good fight. Thank you.